everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Canopy Conversations, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of Canopy, proving yet again that yes, Canopy partners, they're just like us. I'm Keenan McCarthy, standing in as your host today because in a surprising twist, we're hosting the host. That's right. Today's guest isn't just the founder of a podcast that garners 4 listeners per episode. He's also a beloved Canopyan who wears many hats in the Canopy universe. His rise from the lawless pinball arcades of South Jersey to a first-class ticket aboard the Gene Ludwig Express was as improbable as it was unstoppable. He's a man of many passions: shoes, dogs, being organized, and of course, technology that benefits our banks. A connoisseur of the haziest IPAs, yet a man who drinks wine like my 1-year-old drinks sparkling water. A loving husband, a relatable father, and one of the finest human beings you'll ever meet. Lady and gentlemen, it is with great pleasure and just a hint of fear that this episode might cost me my job that I introduce Canopy's operating partner, head of platform, and my boss, the one and only Eric Schwartz.
Hands down the best introduction that we've done on this podcast. And I mean, I may go out on a limb now, but my guess is that this is going to be the best episode we've done yet because, to your point, the microphones have switched, but the real host is finally in the hosting chair.
Whoa.
Well done,
Ken. We'll see about that. We'll see. We just got started. We could really crater from here.
Well, it's good for the 4 people that listen to this thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Know, hey,
exactly.
We listen to the first 30 seconds. That's all I need to know.
And stop now. All right. That's a wrap, folks. Thank you for listening. All right. Let's get into some questions here. We've got to at least get into one question. Let's see how far we make it. Now, I know you like to typically start these podcasts off with a bit of an origin story. And I alluded in that preamble to your pinball wizardry. So let's hop on the DeLorean. Let's travel back to 1985 so that you can give our listener a bit more context as to what I was alluding to.
Yeah. Love the Back to the Future analogy. And I have vivid memories of seeing Back to the Future 2 in the one screen movie theater in my town growing up. And that was a highlight of my kind of preteen era. So I am the child of carnies, I like to say, meaning my great-grandfather started an arcade business, and it was actually a shooting gallery in Center City, Philadelphia in the late 1920s, early 30s during the Depression. And that eventually expanded to include a handful of arcades and a hotel on the South Jersey Shore, and eventually whittled down to a single arcade on the South Jersey Shore when I was born. And so I grew up in Wildwood, New Jersey, right north of Cape May. And my dad took over the business after going to law school and realizing he didn't want to be a lawyer. And starting at age 13, I worked in the store during the summer. And started as a change boy, so I'm not sure if I can still do it, but for a period of time could measure out $5 worth of quarters just by dipping my hand in my giant pouch of change and weighing it out by memory. And then eventually I was promoted after walking the floor with a probably 20-pound bag of change to being a counter boy, which involved me giving out valuable prizes for the people that rolled in with tickets from playing skee ball and such.
The counting change just by sticking your hand in it would be just the coolest bar trick. I think you got to bring that one back.
I do. I impressed lots of people in college and then stopped impressing them, I guess. That's why I went into fintech.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, so for a 7-year-old Keenan McCarthy, arcade owner would have been like in the Hall of Fame of amazing parent jobs. So I consider you a very lucky man. That's up there with like ice cream taster. And for me, it would have been like zoologist or something like that.
Well, the good news is we had an ice cream shop actually in the arcade. So I got, my parents were both ice cream tasters and arcade.
Oh my gosh,
so there you go.
Get out of here.
Yeah.
The perfect life.
In many ways it was.
Yeah. So looking back on that now, as you you were really watching your parents operate a small business.
Yeah.
So what lessons did you glean from that experience that still resonate with you as the operating partner of Canopy today?
Yeah. So I guess like fundamentally, it showed me the power of entrepreneurship and what being part of a small business was, and that small businesses are really the backbone of, you know, our towns and communities. I grew up, you know, really surrounded by kids and families that also own small businesses in town. There was no one, there weren't Wall Street bankers where I was growing up, and there were lawyers, but they were, you know, kind of small town lawyers, not corporate lawyers, the types of folks that we work with, you know, today at the fund. So for me, it really showed the importance of small businesses in driving like a sense of community and providing a you know, income and style of life that my parents and my grandparents before them afforded us. So that was maybe like one of the macro things. The other thing, I guess maybe there were three. The other thing that comes to mind, or another thing that comes to mind, is that work doesn't end at 5 p.m. You know, I give my dad a tremendous amount of credit. He was always home for dinner, but oftentimes went back to the store, especially during the summertime, because, you know, we were open until 10, 11 o'clock at night. And but, you know, during family dinners, it was always we're talking shop and focusing on, you know, what's going on at the store and, you know, challenges, all that fun stuff. So there was always shop talk around the dinner table. And then I guess the last part of the experience, apropos to what we do and our portfolio companies do, is, you know, times change and you need to as well. You know, I think about when, and I was born in the 70s, and then 70s, 80s, arcades were still a thing. Still super popular. Then you get in the 90s and the advent of the home entertainment console and Nintendo and Sega and PlayStation, all of a sudden, and now, of course, you do all this on your phone. Arcade business changed a lot. And it was a lot less about how do you, you know, have that arcade experience and like what else can you do in that same type of footprint to give people a fun experience that doesn't involve playing a video game that you could play on a device in your pocket. And that's when, you know, dad evolved the business to focus more on redemption, meaning the games you play for tickets. And that's kind of where the story is today.
Well, speaking of games that you play for tickets, before we hop back in the DeLorean and do a little more time travel, let's look around, let's close our eyes and look around that arcade. You can bring one game back with us.
Yeah.
To set up in the Canopy office as a stress reliever, maybe something to kind of like put in a little bit of a social center, get people chatting around the water cooler, but in this case, around your favorite arcade game or what you think would be the best. What are you bringing?
Pac-Man. That it's easy. And not only would I do it, I did it back when I was at what company now called IntraFi. So when Promontory Interfinancial Network got off the ground and we got office space in Arlington, we had a little break room. Canteen. And my dad had an old Pac-Man at the store that needed a little bit of TLC.
Is this the one where you have kind of like four players sitting around it, or is it just a one?
No, this
player?
The upright is a single player.
Yeah, okay.
So he trucked it down from Jersey, and I was actually at a picnic, an IntraFi picnic a couple of weeks ago. And one of the long timers there told me it is still, IntraFi has moved offices since and they brought it with them. It is still there. They've had to do a little bit of upgrading to the hardware and everything, but the Pac-Man is still in place. And the reason that I love Pac-Man so much, it was created in 1979 and then brought to market in 1980, kind of like me. And it was the first video game, believe it or not, at the time that was not kind of focused on violence and kind of blowing things up, or you think about Space Invaders and Galaga. Pac-Man was intentionally designed to be something that kids can play, that adults can play, that men and women can play. And it was kind of a neat kind of shift in the way video game design was back then, that was trying to be a lot more inclusive and touch on the needs and desires of lots of different people instead of, frankly, just young boys.
Oh man, that is great. And I think you absolutely need to bring Pac-Man into the office. Get that thing set up.
Courtney will agree it works well with our aesthetic, but I'll run it by her.
I'll maybe get it like in like a leopard print design, then she'll approve it.
Fair enough.
All right, McFly. We're hopping back in the DeLorean. We're leaving the 80s behind us, and we're racing into the 90s. All right, this is where you head south to Georgetown University to kick off your DC dream. Now we're going to kind of blast through that, go through the 2000s. You worked for two companies that in their own unique ways have set you up perfectly for the role you have today at the crossroads of financial services and technology. So let's park the car, park the DeLorean here. And I want to let you kind of dive into those roles that helped you develop this perfect and unique blend of expertise.
Yeah. So in 2001, I graduated from college and I had a job and was intending to go to New York to be a baby investment banker at Credit Suisse First Boston. And 2 months before graduation, I got a call from the recruiter letting me know that, reminding me, I guess, that the tech bubble had burst and that the tech M&A group that I was supposed to join had overhired. And they gave me an option, either come work for us, see what happens, or we'll pay you half your salary, take the year off and join the analyst class of 2002. And I said, I'll take the money. I did not know what I would do with the year off. And it just so turned out that a professor that I worked for at Georgetown grew up with Gene in York, Pennsylvania. And the way the story was told to me is, so Dr. Walker's family owned a haberdashery in York and sold suits. And so I believe that Gene's first suit came from Dr. Walker's family store. Gene's suits obviously have gotten significantly nicer over the years, but I'm glad that he was able to start from simple beginnings. So David introduced me to Gene, and Gene was looking for a young guy to help get Promontory Financial Group off the ground. And Project One at Promontory Financial Group was starting to work on a business plan for a company eventually called Promontory Interfinancial Network, now called IntraFi. And quite literally on day one of the job, I started working on building the business plan. Here's a quick fact. We didn't know how to write a business plan. So we quite literally walked across the street to Barnes & Noble to the business book section and bought every book there about writing business plans. And then eventually, you know, read through them and came up with the plan and raised a bunch of money and got that business off the ground formally in 2002.
Would have been nice to have a little ChatGPT to summarize that for you.
For sure. And I think about my PowerPoint skills there and even the Excel that we were working on. It was, basic, but it got the job done.
Sure did.
So at IntraFi, I had the privilege of becoming embedded in the technical team that was actually building the product itself, the matching engine, which we hired Accenture to do. So I worked hand in glove with Accenture for about 2 years on that product build. I spent a stint in sales and talking with bank CFOs and treasurers about their funding needs, and then ended my tenure at which is called IntraFi as the product manager for the cash sweep product called IND. Around 2007, I married one of my coworkers, and I quickly decided she did not necessarily agree, but we can either live together, commute together, or work together, pick two. And decided living together and commuting together would be okay. Working together, maybe we shouldn't do as much. So I talked with Gene and moved over to Promontory Financial Group in 2008, just in time for the financial crisis, and got to have that whole experience. So going from the technical, fintech before it was fintech, over to the advisory side at Promontory, where you and I worked together very closely. Walker and I met and shared an office for quite a while. And spent a bunch of time advising on liquidity risk, market risk, eventually led client coverage there. And then before I left Promontory after 13 years, led our strategy practice, where we did all of our work was focused on, in some way or another, bank fintech partnerships, whether they be how do banks partner with banks, how do banks acquire fintechs, how do fintechs work with banks. So that in many ways provided a great foundation for the type of work we do here at Canopy with the Alliance and the platform team and servicing our portfolio companies and talking with our strategic LPs about how they can better avail themselves of technology and, and partner with fintechs.
Well, great, Scott, Eric. We have made it back to the present, and you're still here, which means you have successfully gotten your mom to fall back in love with your dad. And now a full halfway through the pod and a dozen Back to the Future references later, we finally get to the point where we get to talk about Canopy.
So, let's do it.
I don't know. You want to take back that comment about the podcasting role? Oh, this is
so far so good, Keenan.
Okay, yeah, some stellar podcasting so far by Mace. Yeesh. I mentioned at the top that you wear a lot of hats here at Canopy. Okay, so I'm going to radically simplify those hats into three buckets, and then I want you to kind of add some additional flavor as you will. The first bucket that we're going to talk about. Helping our strategic LPs, right? The financial institutions that form the Canopy Alliance and make Canopy who we are. So tell me, what should our strategic LPs know about getting the most out of Canopy?
Well, I think fundamentally, like we exist, or our team exists at Canopy to serve our LPs. So while Keenan, you and I are no longer in a professional services advisory capacity, at least formally, that's what we do day in and day out. So whenever I speak with LPs, or certainly new LPs that we're bringing them on, my biggest recommendation is, like, get familiar with the types of companies that we've invested in, use the resources that we've created, Canopy Connect being the first, second, and third one that comes to mind. And, you know, don't be shy, ask questions, let's set up time. It's a two-way street, and want to make sure that we're able to, you know, serve you, answer your questions. The more we know about the challenges that your bank is facing, the opportunities that you're taking a look at, the easier it is for us to do our jobs, the easier it is for us to feed some of that information back to our investment team and find solutions and companies out there that serve your needs. So, you know, back on Canopy Connect for half a second, we spent a bunch of time last year building out this platform that brings together all the thought leadership that we've produced, whether they be in the blogs, white papers, presentations, all the webinars that we've done, along with detailed information on all of our portfolio companies. This is intended to kind of give scale to, you know, people like you and me, Keenan, where there's only so many conversations we can have each week with our LPs, but this is a way to help kind of share this information across the LP base, and everyone at at the banks that partner with us is welcome to and has access to Canopy Connect. So it's not just, you know, a one-to-one type of thing. Share it with your colleagues and let them take advantage of all the knowledge and materials together.
So true. So true. It's available. Thanks for the Canopy Connect call out. We definitely want to get people on that one. So let's move on to the second bucket. Helping our portfolio companies. Among many of the responsibilities there, this bucket really includes helping our portfolio companies with their go-to-market strategies and selling into banks, right? So the question here is, what are some of the most common pitfalls that you see fintech startups encounter when entering the banking market specifically?
I guess one thing that comes to mind, and we've helped solve this through, frankly, a lot of the work that you've done, is setting expectations around how long the sales process really takes.
Oh, that I've done? How did that question get in there?
Kudos to you, Keenan. Huh. You want to talk a little bit about the vendor management playbook?
No, I want to hear you. This is you are our guest. Please, please. I wouldn't dare take that time away from you.
Yes. Well, so, like, having a truly an understanding of what it takes to do business with regulated institutions, we have the benefit of many of our founders and portfolio companies have sold into banks, partnered with banks for some time, since they get the joke. For technical founders who, you know, come from, or not necessarily come from, the financial services background, it can be really hard to, you know, understand and appreciate how much longevity you really need, and frankly, money you need to and potentially burn through, to get to not just a handshake deal like, yes, we want to onboard you, we want to engage you, but actually have revenue coming in through the through a bank partnership. That is, I would say, the single hardest thing for companies that are selling into banks, whether they be, you know, fintechs that exclusively work with banks, or, you know, enterprise software companies that have banks as a vertical. The other bit too, and it's, you know, somewhat tangentially related, is just the importance of compliance. You know, understanding that, you know, having really strong cyber risk and operational risk processes in place will be critical when you go through vendor onboarding, because as a vendor to and provider of services to a regulated institution, this is something that the regulators are going to ask about time in and time out. And if you don't have the policies, procedures, documentation, processes in place, it can really be a non-starter.
Yeah, absolutely. So between bucket one and bucket two, you are constantly working to bridge that gap between our LPs and our portcos and our pipeline companies.
Sure.
I think it'd be really great if you could share an example of a recent success story where that alignment paid off. Anything come to mind?
I'm trying to think of, yeah. So, well, I guess a couple things come to mind. I don't want to name specific names to make any one LP or portco feel bad or
yeah,
highlighted.
No,
but
only mine. You can say my name if
yes. Yeah, so Keenan, the driving force behind this exercise. So, like in the fraud and identity space, this is an area that so many of our banks have challenges. And you know, one of our LPs had been talking to another one of our portfolio companies that provides all sorts of services in fraud and identity. And you know, the fact that one, we were able to introduce the two parties, two, help through the contracting phase, meaning you know, help kind of almost work both sides of the deal, explain to the bank why the portfolio company had a certain position when negotiating the contract, explain to the portco why a bank would want to stand really firm on certain terms on the contract, and eventually help get that relationship across the finish line, is hugely kind of inspiring and energizing. And by the way, we've done it over 100 times. So like seeing you know, very directly how the power of the alliance, the openness that our bank partners have in engaging with, whether they be our portfolio companies or just pipeline companies more broadly, and excitement that our portfolio companies have in engaging with our LPs is just inspiring and energizing. And quite frankly, it's why we come to work every day.
And then lastly, we have the third bucket, which is managing the internal operations at Canopy. And this is such a broad category. I'm not even going to try to attempt to summarize it. But all of these things and all these responsibilities do highlight something that we at Canopy know very well about you, Eric. It's that you are a master of organizational skills and time management, also known as OCD. I know you love testing out and using different types of kind of organizational and time management techniques or technology. Curious if there are any methods or any technology that have really made a difference in how you juggle everything on your plate.
Yeah, I mean, I guess some of it comes down to like when Andre and I had our first kid 15 years ago, I quickly realized I needed to figure out how to do more with less. And there was always less time and wanting to prioritize family. And then when we had our daughter 12 years ago, it became even more challenging. Plus all the other things that make us from, I like to call it the 5 to 9, not the 9 to 5. So the extracurriculars that we're involved in, the volunteer stuff. And I think so much of it comes down to like how you're prioritizing your time. But I've come across two tools that I use every single day that help me keep my life in order. And honestly, if I didn't have them, if these just disappeared, I would be a complete disaster because I wouldn't be able to run my life. The first one's Trello, which is kind of a Kanban board that we use on our team to help keep track of all sorts of projects and just have like a single point of reference for all the projects that we're working on. And then the second tool is Todoist. That kind of gamifies to-do lists by you get points as you add and accomplish different tasks. And you also have like a running list of how many consecutive days you've completed at least the requisite number of tasks that you set for yourself. And like having that structure around the way I kind of do work has been really helpful because it makes it kind of fun and gamifies it. But one tool that I'm just now starting to get into is happily now a portfolio company. It's called Smart Suite, and this is a no-code platform for building, you know, the types of tooling that you have in Airtable and Monday.com and Atlassian. And I'm super excited and have already been leaning in, as has our broader team, with the team at Smart Suite on building some of the tooling that we have here at Canopy to help run our operations more efficiently. And hopefully in the coming months, we're going to be able to expose some of that to our LPs so they can get a taste of it as well.
Nice little plug there. Appreciate that. Always.
No problem.
Now, before I let you go, I have one more question for you, but this one is not from me. All right. Listeners, again, or listener, before Canopy was such a podcasting dynamo, we ran a few tests, and one of those first test runs included a very special episode where Eric was interviewed by his adorable daughter, Nadia Schwartz, and I happened to get my hands on this. So I just want to listen in on some of the hard-hitting journalism that came out of Nadia here.
What is your, like, if you were to quit going to Canopy, like, in 2 years, let's say, what would be your dream job?
I think my dream job would be running a tennis pro shop at a country club or a racket club, because I love tennis a lot. I love the equipment part of tennis. I know how to string rackets and do other things that are, you know, kind of hard or different. And I love learning about the different parts of the sport and, of course, playing the sport. So if I could do anything, I think running a pro shop would be a fun thing to do.
I mean, I don't know why you had me do this podcast. You should have just brought Nadia back.
Oh, she's in school. Not available.
So tennis pro. Would you be one of those tennis pros who kind of lets the membership win for the tips, or are you going in to beat them down every time?
No, you know, I subscribe to not everyone gets a showing up trophy, and if you're gonna win, you got to win honestly.
Hey, well done. Would you be drinking hazies out there on the course, or do you?
100%.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. There we go, Eric. Well, Eric, it has been an absolute pleasure, both on this podcast and for the several years we've worked together. So, thank you for letting me ask you a few questions here, and thanks for joining us.
Awesome job, Kenan. Love spending the time together.
All right, folks, that's another one in the books for Canopy Conversations. Nadia, take us home.
Thanks for inviting me on to your pod.
Of course. Thank you. I hope you enjoyed Canopy Conversations.
Canopy Conversations is confidential and may not be relied upon as investment, legal, or tax advice. Please carefully review Canopy Connect terms and conditions for further information.